This is Arts Alive for this Saturday, April 23rd. I'm Brian Lauritsen. Today, movie making and music making go hand in hand, so it's no surprise that many film and television composers make their home in L.A. But many of those composers have a different side, shown not on a big or small screen, but in their writing for the concert hall.
It is the thing I love. It is the thing I live for. It's the only thing I would do after I get that call from my mom who says she forgot to tell me about the trust fund.
Elliot Goldkind makes a living in film and TV, but he says his modern classical music is the real him. Goldkind is one of the local composers featured in this year's Here Now Festival, and he's one of the people we'll talk to about the unique festival in a moment. Also on the program today, 1940s gangsters meet Mozart at a radio station for Redlands Opera Theater's final production of the year. We talk to the company's founders in a bit. And on Ask the Dean, are studio musicians superhuman? That's the question for Dean Rob Cudieta of the USC Thornton School of Music. First, here's Alan Chapman with the Arts News.
From the Arts Desk today, mourning a singer in his prime and a tenor without a soprano. Japanese-American countertenor Brian Asawa has died at age 49. He studied at UCLA and was a graduate of San Francisco Opera's Merula and Adler training programs. He was well known in the Bay Area for his roles in San Francisco Opera's productions of Benjamin Britten's Midsummer Night's Dream and Stravinsky's The Rake's Progress, among others. He performed in opera houses around the world, from the Met to the Paris Opera. Asawa had recently launched a management company for singers and directors. Opera News called him a singer in his prime, an electric performer, his fearless performing style supported by a voice of arresting beauty and expressivity. San Francisco Opera has set up the Brian Asawa Memorial Fund in his honor. The fund will go toward Merula Opera Program participants, and especially to countertenors. And tenor Jonas Kaufmann found himself stranded on stage recently when Romanian soprano Angela Gheorghiu did not make her planned entrance in the third act of a production of Puccini's Tosca at Vienna State Opera. After an awkward silence, Kaufmann sang, in the style of Puccini, "Non abbiamo il soprano." We don't have a soprano, before excusing himself from the stage. The opera then began again, with Gheorghiu making her appearance. So was it an honest error, or was it something else? Well, at an earlier performance, Kaufmann received such passionate applause that he sang a rare encore of an aria, something Gheorghiu has previously indicated she disapproves of. Her missed entrance came right after Kaufmann once again sang an encore. Gheorghiu herself has not spoken publicly about the incident. That's the Arts News for Saturday, April 23rd. On this date in 1857, composer Ruggiero Leoncavallo was born in Naples. His father was a judge, and Leoncavallo said the plot of his most famous opera, Pagliacci, was inspired by a real-life murder trial over which his father had presided. For Arts Alive, I'm Alan Chapman.
This is Arts Alive on Classical KUSC. I'm Brian Lauritsen. 5 years ago, composer Hugh Levick and cellist Timothy Liu recognized a void. There was no real concerted showcase for new music by contemporary Los Angeles composers. And with that, the Here Now Music Festival was born. The fifth annual event, which is made up of four separate concerts with different ensembles, kicked off Thursday and continues through the weekend. Contributing reporter Tim Grieving spoke with three of this year's featured LA composers.
Composer Catherine Bostick likes drama.
And I love the fact that music is an incredible platform for storytelling. And it's one of the reasons why I do like film scoring and writing for theater and other platforms.
Like most composers in Los Angeles, and hence most of the composers featured in this weekend's Here Now Festival, Bostick's bread and butter has been writing music for the stage and screen. Her scoring work includes the comedy Dear White People and several documentaries for PBS. Up until now, actual concert writing has been a small slice of the pie.
But it's definitely something that I want to delve into and grow, because I really feel that, for me, autonomy is extremely important in terms of being able to have my own voice as an artist, where a lot of the projects that I've dealt with in the past are collaborative.
Bostick will be represented this weekend with a piece she was commissioned to write a few years ago for the woodwind trio Third Wheel.
I was really struck by the way the bears were infiltrating these exclusive gated communities. Mother Nature doesn't deal with hierarchy and doesn't deal with exclusive rights and sensibilities. So I just really liked the way I kept hearing these stories on the news about these bears that were going into people's swimming pools and just leaving when they wanted to leave. It starts off very slow and sort of thoughtful and engaged in terms of sort of this dreamlike quality, and then it gets more and more active and more playful as the day goes on. Each instrument might have its limitations insofar as range and timbre and textures, but, you know, it's still a menu of endless possibilities. You know, music's this incredible language that if you allow yourself to have that as the conduit for what you want to express, there's no limit.
Bostick's piece, Tres Osos y Una Playa, or Three Bears and a Beach, will be on tomorrow evening's program at the First Lutheran Church of Venice. Another composer who found the woodwinds possibilities endless is Elliot Goldkind, whose piece Buddha in Der Glory will also be featured in tomorrow's concert in Venice.
I lived in Berlin in 1987. One of the ways I was trying to teach myself German when I lived in Berlin was I was walking around with a collection of Rilke poems. I loved the poem, Buddha in Glory. You know, there's a kind of weird Germanic take on mysticism in a lot of his work, and I thought it would be a good platform to do something sonically that was different, interesting, and to do something for not just flute and voice, which this piece is, but for multiphonic flute. I thought, well, let's do something for multiphonic flute and not make it about exploiting the difficulties or the tricks that you can do, similar to Rilke and my understanding of his treatment of the subject matter. Let's employ the multiphonics as a way of just altering and creating an entirely new take on the sonic character of the flute. Unlike some other treatments of text, it's not really so much word painting, the flute and the voice. They're not entirely independent. I would like to think it sounds like they're coordinated, obviously, and they work together, but it certainly isn't something where it feels like there's an accompaniment and a voice and where they are in lockstep. They're both very spacious and they're both very free, which, again, I think is a lot of the character of the poem.
Like Bostick, Goldkind spends most of his career inside the film and TV world. He scored several indie movies and documentaries, including one on the LA architect John Lautner, but his real meat and potatoes is being a TV music editor. So for him, writing for the concert hall is a breath of fresh air.
It is the thing I love. It is the thing I live for. It's the only thing I would do after I get that call from my mom who says she forgot to tell me about the trust fund, the classical music, modern classical, concert music, serious music, whatever you want to call it. That is the real me.
Jeff Beal is a veteran film and TV composer, best known these days for his dark, jazz-soaked score for the Netflix series House of Cards. In addition to his multiple Emmy-winning music for TV, he's never stopped writing quote-unquote serious music, including a concerto for trumpet and orchestra and a recent choral work commissioned by the Los Angeles Master Chorale. This year, the Here Now Festival branched out from just soliciting submissions, as they've done in the past, and actually commissioned a few brand new works. One is Beal's, an episodic piece called Anxiety Option, which will receive its world premiere this afternoon at 3 p.m. at the Miles Memorial Playhouse in Santa Monica on a program of all electroacoustic music. Beal will perform the piece himself on both trumpet and flugelhorn with a pre-recorded electronic accompaniment.
I'm not really a political person in my work, but sometimes as artists, you just sort of take the temperature of the world and it just sort of seeps into you. And as I started writing this, it became very clear that I was sort of channeling this feeling, you know, this political season and the terrorism stuff happening around the world and also the Syrian refugee crisis. Anxiety is used both by the terrorists to instill fear, but it's also used by politicians sometimes. There's something Trump said a few months ago my supporters love me so much that I could stand in the middle of Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody and they'd still vote for me. And that just struck me as completely, it's insane. But it also sounds very much like something a terrorist would say. And I just felt like that was a fun phrase to use as sort of a springboard. So I've sort of sampled that. And you know, here I can show you. I've woven it in a few places. And it sort of comes and goes. It's deconstructed at parts.
They say, I have the most loyal people. And you know what else they say about my people? The Pulse.
And obviously, I'll be playing trumpet on top of that, so there'll be a voice improvising through all this, you know, on top of the texture, in and out of it.
So it sounds like you set yourself a performance challenge in addition to just a compositional challenge.
It keeps me connected to a few things. One is that visceral process of being a musician, especially being an improviser, which I love to do. And it also sort of keeps me connected to that part of my expression, which is sort of pure and unfiltered and in the moment.
The Here Now Music Festival, featuring compositions by Catherine Bostick, Elliot Goldkind, and 21 other Los Angeles composers, including a world premiere by Jeff Beal this afternoon at 3 p.m., runs through tomorrow evening. For tickets and more information, visit herenowmusicfestival.com. For Arts Alive, I'm Tim Grieve.
They say I am the most loyal people. Where I could stand in the middle of Fifth Avenue.
You're listening to Arts Alive on Classical KUSC. I'm Brian Lawrence, and next Saturday morning at 8, more stories from the arts in Southern California. Until then, you can check the podcast. Past episodes of Arts Alive are available anytime at the podcast page. Go to kusc.org/artsalive. Coming up, Mozart's Don Giovanni time travels to the 1940s. But now, here once again is Alan Chapman with this week's Around Town Arts Calendar.
Here's a bit of what's happening around town, starting as we always do with a free event. The Millennium Consort Singers return to Pomona College tonight for a musical celebration of the Bard. Noises, sounds, and sweet airs will mark the 400th anniversary of Shakespeare's death. The program includes music by Vaughan Williams and others, interspersed with readings by English actor Julian Barnes from Shakespeare's sonnets and plays. The Millennium Consort Singers at Bridges Hall of Music in Claremont tonight at 8 p.m., For details, pomona.edu/events, and again, admission is free. Also tonight, the La Mirada Symphony's American Masters Pops Concert includes two premieres, plus highlights from Gershwin's Porgy and Bess and favorites by Leroy Anderson. The orchestra will premiere Chris Anderson's American Mosaic, written in the aftermath of 9/11, and a work by Cody Gill. That's the La Mirada Symphony's American Masters Concert, tonight at 8 p.m. at La Mirada Theater for the Performing Arts, and you can find details at lamiradasymphony.com. And you can hear two of Puccini's one-act operas performed in the new Musco Center for the Arts at Chapman University. Opera Chapman, in collaboration with the Chapman Orchestra, presents Gianni Schicchi and Suor Angelica tonight at 7:30 and tomorrow afternoon at 3. For tickets, chapman.universitytickets.com. And that's a bit of what's happening around town this week. For details on these and other cultural events in Southern California, visit performingartslive.com. For Arts Alive, I'm Alan Chapman.
Coming up on Ask the Dean, do studio musicians ever get to practice? But first, Best Friends, Sopranos, and Redlands residents Krista Stevens and Tiana Dye were driving all over Southern California for performance opportunities. Wouldn't it be great, they thought, if there was an opera company closer to home? So they founded one. Redlands Opera Theater opened its doors in 2012. We first met music director Krista and artistic director Tayana here on Arts Alive shortly thereafter. Now they're back, and KUSC's Kelsey McConnell asked how it felt to fill that hometown opera void. Here's Krista Stevens.
It's been great. Like, for me as a native of Redlands, I mean, I come to LA all the time to sing, which I love, but it is nice to be able to have some professional opportunity in Redlands.
Have you discovered some homegrown talent?
We have. It's really exciting, especially we had a couple of local people in Faust, which was our fall production, and we have a couple in this show as well in Don Giovanni, and we're very excited.
One of the other things we spoke about before when you were here in 2014 was about how you guys are both really committed to being fiscally responsible. Not necessarily a very sexy topic, but it's something that a lot of arts organizations should probably think more about, because no matter how much creativity and talent you have, if you don't figure out your finances, you're just not going to have that kind of longevity. So as this company has evolved, how have you made sure that you stay on good financial footing?
There have been plenty of times when I've kind of wanted to see something look a little more aesthetically in line with what I was sort of imagining in my head. And sometimes you just have to make sacrifices, because at the end of the day, our audience base is coming to hear beautiful singing. Mm-hmm. And we need to make sure that our singers are compensated fairly. So mm-hmm. sometimes that means sacrificing things on the back end to make sure that we pull off some good singing. So, I mean, it's kind of like a give and take.
As our budget continues to grow, we're going to start adding in other layers, but taking care of our singers has always been our top priority.
One of the things that we're going to be speaking about as a production team is bringing in a conductor and then bring in instruments from there. So yeah. We're going to start small again in the fiscally responsible vein that we have established.
We have a segment on Arts Alive called Ask the Dean, where we asked Dean Rob Cudiat a different things. And one of the questions that came in was, why do opera singers need a conductor?
It doesn't work when you have too many captains. Singers all have different ideas about tempi and how this should go and how that should go. And that's great. But you kind of need like one person in charge.
That's one of the beautiful things about singers, is that everybody is so different and they interpret things differently. Mm-hmm. But you need to kind of have a leader up there. You know, maybe you get into it and you lose your place. Every once in a while, the emotion overtakes you and you kind of need someone to kind of look at and get you back in line.
Your last mm-hmm. opera of the season opens today. Tell me about Don Giovanni.
This is a very exciting production. Our original concept for the show was to do a concert version. Our stage director, Christina Jensen, came up with a really amazing concept to set it in a 1940 radio station. And you have a bunch of actor singers that are coming in to do their job, to do their recording. It's a lot of fun. It's sort of a backstage pass. And you have these, you know, interesting sort of stereotypical 40s characters. You have some, you know, gangster type guys, and you have a sort of a den mother character and sort of the diva actress character. So it's kind of fun.
Yeah, and it's presented a good acting challenge for us, because, you know, not only do we have the operatic character that we're playing, but then we have this person portraying that operatic character.
And what about next season? It'll be your fourth full season.
Yeah, we have some exciting announcements. We will be doing our gala in the fall again. And then we're going to do something that we haven't done before. We're going to do a true double bill. We're going to be doing Suor Angelica and Gianni Schicchi. And our goal is to set them in two different locations within the campus of the Congregational Church. There's kind of a smaller chapel that lends itself really well for Suor Angelica. And then we're going to take Gianni Schicchi and set it in the 19th century and move that into Kimberly Hall, where we can bring out all of our great 19th century costumes and set pieces. And we're going to be debuting Golda Berkman with our company. And she is a wonderful young talent in LA. We're really, really excited about that. And then this past season, we did a Mall in the Night Visitors for the first time, and it was very successful. And so one of our patrons wants us to continue to put on a Mall in the Night Visitors every season and have it be kind of a permanent part of the Redlands musical season. So we do that around Epiphany. Mm-hmm. Then we are going to be doing a Gilbert and Sullivan review as part of our opera at the Gables concert series. And then in the spring, we're going to do Carmen.
We're going to do sort of an interesting, almost opera in the round type thing with that one. Christina Jensen, our stage director, she comes up with really interesting concepts that allow the audience to almost become a part of it instead of just observing it. And so it's kind of neat the way that she goes and thinks about things.
You are both women, and that your director of Don Giovanni is a woman. Have you consciously tried to give opportunities to women? The arts can be kind of old-fashioned when it comes to things like gender equality or diversity.
I don't know if we necessarily did it on purpose, but Christina just, she presented herself, and we liked where she was going, and it was certainly a perk that she was a female, so... You know, she came on board, and then Jessica Bondi, who's our stage manager and our assistant director, she's also female, and it's just, it was funny how it worked out, but it works very well.
I don't think it was, like, consciously this uber-feminist movement. We were like, but at the same time, you're right, that there, by and large, have been more limited opportunities for women to serve in leadership positions within the classical music community, and so the fact that this is... you know, so female leader heavy is kind of cool, because we're hoping maybe it'll inspire other women to just kind of pick up and start things on their own.
Now that you have a couple years of administration under your belts, what would be your advice to people out there who are thinking maybe they want to start their own company or ensemble?
Be organized.
Yeah.
Sometimes as artists, we're not, and you have to be. You have to have your paperwork in order. Mm-hmm. It's about being hyper-vigilant about your organization, because the minute you let something slip, things just start to unravel.
I think the best thing artists can do is surround themselves with people who are not artists, who are very business-minded, who can help them. Also decide early on what your vision is. Like, where are you going to put your money? If you have this chunk of money that you've been given for your company, where are you going to invest that money? Whatever the vision is, it needs to be clear from the get-go. I think that that's probably the best way people could find success. You really have to bring something new to the table, because there's so much competition out there.
Krista Stevens is the music director, and Tayana Dai is the artistic director of Redlands Opera Theater. Their final production of the season, the 1940s set Don Giovanni by Mozart, opens tonight, 7:30, at the First Congregational Church of Redlands. Performances through April 30th, and you can visit redlandsoperatheater.com for tickets, and that is theater spelled R-E at the end. KUSC's Kelsey McConnell brought us that story. And now, here's KUSC's Gail Eichenthal with a question about time to prepare for Dean Rob Kudieta of the USC Thornton School of Music.
Dean Rob, today's question comes from Chatsworth, from Maurizio, who asks about studio musicians. Very interesting question. He says, musicians in symphony orchestras have years to become familiar, of course, with the repertoire. But soundtrack musicians are paid by the hour, as far as he knows, and they have to learn music every time they do a gig. They have new music to learn. Do they get their parts before a recording session, or do they have to learn on the spot at the studio? It seems this would leave them very little time to rehearse.
Yes. Yeah, wonderful question, and very relevant to living in Los Angeles, where we have so much of the film scoring industry here. I went to Christy Morrell and several other of our faculty who actually do many session works for movies. And they're absolutely right that it's fundamentally different. For example, in our Thornton Symphony, one of the functions of us doing that is make sure the students learn repertoire. In fact, we've really come up with, you know, 50 pieces that every student has to know how to play. And we make sure that they have played those when they left. When you get to film scores, it's all different because it's performed once, it's performed in the recording studio, and it's done. And so how does that really happen, especially with the high cost of musicians? So in talking with them, hardly anyone could ever remember a time where they got the music in advance, which I found just phenomenal. Now, if there's a major solo in a piece, you might get it in advance. In advance could be the day before. So they really, I know, they really are learning. But most of the time, and I know I used to be a studio musician, and it was the same thing 30 years ago. You walk in and the music's sitting on your stand and you record. And sometimes the first take's the best one, actually. So that's how it works. They do not see the music until they're actually there. Then the conductor will rehearse a little bit, but oftentimes they're recording. That's where they're working on mic placement and these other things, and the director, the composer are hearing it. So you play it through once and you think, oh, that wasn't too bad, but they might change something on the spot. So they're constantly changing the music. Things work, don't work. So they are seeing the music for the first time and they're part of the process of it changing.
So, the film is actually showing on a screen?
Yes. More so on screens to the conductor now, but the traditional way you've probably seen movies where there's the big screen, that is still done very, very much so. So they're playing that and the director's watching it and they're putting it all together. So the way a session usually works, I found this fascinating, is that you get an email saying you're going to do this session and you're going to do a single, which is a 3-hour session, or a double, which is, of course, is 6 hours with a break in between. Each hour is 50 minutes of playing. So when they come in to their 50 minutes, there's cues and they're on the folder. And, you know, some film cues might be 8 seconds long or 4 seconds long or 15 seconds long. So each one is done. The conductor will simply say, we're going to do cue 17. You pull out cue 17, you play it, and you're done. So they'll call out a cue number, they'll start to rehearse, and then they'll record. It's all done to a metronome that the musicians are hearing in click tracks through their ears, through headphones. And so it's a whole different kind of procedure. But think about that. This music is not easy music to play. And these musicians are expected to look at it and record it. I mean, record it. They're doing a recording that's going to be forever. Literally, these folks are fearless. They're wonderful sight readers. You put anything in front of them, they're going to be able to read it. They pride themselves on that. But they're also pretty easygoing because they have to go with the flow. They cannot be uptight. And I mean, it's a high-pressure situation for sure. And what's interesting, and this was something I could relate to very much, I mean, you got to be a great musician, but your personality and your willingness to go with that and just go with the flow and not create a lot of waves is just as important as your musical skills. I remember sometimes I'd do a session and you'd see somebody come in and they were really a really good musician and they'd ask the wrong questions or have the wrong attitude or whatever. You just knew you'd never see them again because the clock is ticking. So it's both musical skills and a certain kind of personality that can go with the flow that makes these great movie musicians.
Wonderful insight. Thank you, Dean Robb, and thanks, Maurizio, for a great question.
Thank you, Gail.
Do you have a question for Dean Robb Cudietta and his team of experts? Send an email to askthedean@kusc.org. Again, that's askthedean@kusc.org. Or you can submit a question on Twitter. We're at @classicalKUSC and just use the hashtag KUSCAskTheDean. And that wraps up this edition of Arts Alive for this Saturday, the 23rd of April. Next week, join us for more stories about the artists and musicians making creative magic here in Southern California. It's next Saturday at 8 a.m. on Arts Alive. The technical director is Mark Hatwan. Kelsey McConnell is the executive producer. We had help this week from contributing reporter Tim Grieving and KUSC's Gail Eichenthal and Alan Chapman. Thanks as well to Sheila Tepper. I'm Brian Lauritsen. Have a great weekend.